This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. When easy transportation became available, millions and millions of Americans left the crowds and noise and dirt of the inner city for the towns just outside. There, they could own their own home, a little piece of land, and generally lead a nicer life. When those suburbs got too crowded, those with the means moved even further away. Now, that inner ring of suburbs suffers from many of the same problems that hollowed out so many American cities: crime, poverty, poor schools, and aging infrastructure. And now, between continued suburban development and the drive to revitalize the urban core, the problems of the inner burbs are often overlooked. Today, in part three of our suburban series, we take a look at those first-tier suburbs, places like Silver Spring, Maryland, Wilkinsburg, Pennsylvania, and Richmond, California. If you live in one, call and tell us what it's like these days. If you've left, call and tell us why. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is TOTN@NPR.org. And joining us now from his office is Paul Oyaski, the mayor of Euclid, Ohio, a suburb of Cleveland. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hello, Neil. How are you?
Very well today. Mayor, when did you become concerned for the future of Euclid?
Well, I was the development director during the first part of the 1980s and got to see some of the state programs at work. And in 1995, I was elected mayor, and at that time, the issue that crystallized my attention was yet another new interchange out in virgin woodland about 25 miles from downtown Cleveland on Interstate 90 that would only be drawing more wealth and prosperity and new subdivisions from the older parts of Cuyahoga County.
So, in other words, you're feeling that they're getting the support from the state, and Euclid is not.
Well, Euclid has a freeway that was built in the early 1960s. It's not a modern, wide freeway below grade. It's an old freeway. And Euclid actually had more people here in 1960 before the freeway even opened. So the way highway funding has been spent in Ohio is to build more and more infrastructure when the population is not growing. That's what's been happening here for the last 30 years.
Tell us a little bit about Euclid. How many people live there?
Euclid has about 53,000 people, 10.3 square miles, 4 miles of lakefront, northeast of the city of Cleveland. Our history dates back to the George Washington administration.
How close are you to the city of Cleveland itself?
Our western border abuts the city of Cleveland.
Now, Cleveland has also been losing population of late, and there's a lot of effort, though, devoted towards the establishment of things to convince people to either move back in or move there in the first place.
Well, we're doing many of the same things Cleveland has done. There's about 25 cities in Cuyahoga County that ring the central city whose tax bases have not grown with inflation over the last 20 years. Cleveland lost a great deal of value and a great deal of population, and we in the inner ring suburbs are trying to act a little quicker before we lose too much more of our value. But it's many of the same issues: aged housing, brownfields, old factories that are no longer productive, and Cuyahoga County, where Euclid and Cleveland are located, are losing a lot of population to the newer development in the outlying counties.
Yet, obviously, your future is tied to Cleveland as well. If the city continues to go down or goes down further, Euclid is not going to be viable.
Inner-ring suburbs like Euclid are in a public policy gap. I mean, Mayor Cleveland can probably get the President of the United States to come down and tour downtown Cleveland or the Flats. And Cleveland has gotten empowerment zone funding, and Cleveland got UDAG funding when UDAG was available. There are those resources don't exist. I would suggest that Cleveland is a regional asset, but it has been conventional wisdom during my career to kind of run away from Cleveland, and that has to stop. I mean, we have in the inner ring suburbs acknowledged a symbiotic relationship with the older city.
Hmm. So what do you think the future is? Can you get a proportional amount of the funding that's available? Is Euclid going to be able to redevelop its tax base and freshen the housing?
I think we can. I think it takes time. We're trying to identify some new resources, such as an increase in either the state gasoline tax or the federal gasoline tax. There could be some policy changes on tax abatement on mass transit, and there can be some other, I think, regulatory changes that would assist. I understand the world has gone Republican, so you have to have tax credits. But if you had directed tax credits like Ohio used to have in the late 80s, there are ways, I think, to draw investment back in. And we still have a premium location within the region at the intersection of two interstate highways. But as the mayor, you got to be aware of what's happening in the city, but you also have to be aware of external policies that impact your ability to bring about redevelopment.
Mayor Oyaski, thanks very much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Mayor Bye. Paul Oyaski with us from his office in Euclid, Ohio. And here with us in Studio 3A is Bill Hudnut, a senior resident fellow with the Urban Land Institute, who's been studying the plight of some of the nation's first suburbs. His new book is called Halfway to Everywhere, A Portrait of America's First-Tier Suburbs. And Bill Hudnut, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much.
We just heard the mayor of Euclid talking about the problems of his city. They are not unique, are they?
No, they're not unique, but they're symbolic. I was impressed when I was visiting with Mayor Oyaski in his office. He waved his arm and pointed toward the window and said, they can build, meaning the state, they can build $500 million worth of interchanges farther out to suck vitality out of our community, but they can't even pave Euclid Street out in front of our offices. Hmm. Of course, it's been paved now. But that's symbolic, I think, of the policy blind spot, as well as the fact that these communities like Euclid are caught in a crossfire between a fiscal crossfire as well as a demographic crossfire. The demographic crossfire, people are moving out. They associate success with how far they live outside the city, or they're moving back in. There's a trend back toward the city. And the fiscal crossfire is that there's a lot of subsidizing of suburban development on the one hand and downtown development on the other. Mayor Oyaski gave me some figures that indicated almost $40 million was going to downtown Cleveland. He doesn't begrudge them that. But in the same three-year biennial capital budget for the state of Ohio, Euclid gets $125,000 a year. And that's certainly not proportionate if you based it on population. So these communities are distressed. HUD says there are over 400 distressed suburbs in America. And they define distress as being over 20% poverty or a decrease of 5% or more in the population. And that may be an exaggerated figure, but the fact is it's not just Euclid. It's not just the suburbs around Cleveland, the first tier. It's literally everywhere. I think, from Boston to San Francisco.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address, again, is totn@npr.org. And let's take a call from Jessa, who's with us from Lakewood, Colorado.
Hi.
Hi.
I grew up in Wheat Ridge, Colorado, which is just outside of Denver.
Mm-hmm.
And when we first moved there, it was a really nice little neighborhood, a lot of houses built in the 40s and 50s. And as I grew up, a lot of gangs started moving into the area. A lot of the problems that my parents chose that neighborhood because they didn't want to live in a bad area of town, which would have been like the city or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So they chose this little suburban area, and it just sort of became as bad as what they considered the city to be.
And what did they do?
Well, we moved up to Lakewood, which within 2 years turned into just like Wheat Ridge because it's really not that far away. So then we moved on to Littleton, which is like outer suburbia. We live in an area that's between two mountains. It's basically like a little fortress hollow of a town. It's basically just about as far away from the city as we can be.
And still get to work there?
Yeah. Mom used to work in the city and everything, but now it's just everything's based in the suburbs.
Jessa, thanks very much. We appreciate it. The experiences of Jessa's family, again, not unique.
Not unique at all. It's very, very symbolic. I tell a similar story about a family in Cleveland that began with immigrants living downtown, then they moved out a little bit toward the fringe of the city, then they moved into a close-in suburb, and now they've moved like 30 miles out. It's the typical American pattern of use it up, sell it, and then move out. And you can't blame people for wanting to upgrade themselves, but the unintended consequence of this cultural phenomenon of suburbanization is that we're leaving behind us, we're abandoning a great deal of yesterday's investment, and it's deteriorating. And my thesis in this book is that these places, like Euclid, are metropolitan pivot points. And if they fail, or if they go under, or if they are left to deteriorate and decline further, 30 years from now, we're going to see that in the second tier. Lakewood has problems in Colorado, but they're doing a wonderful job under Mayor Steve Burkholder of renovating a great, huge plaza, which had 5,000 parking spaces for a huge regional mall, and they're going to turn that into an urban village. It's possible to come back, and that's the good news. The bad news is the distress. The good news is the opportunity for what you might call restoration.
Let's get a call. This from Cecily, is that right, in Laredo, Texas?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, you're on the air.
I just had a question. I'm wondering how much, in your opinion, do you think the collapse of suburbia is due to the phenomenon of white flight? This is where when a more than minimal percentage of the population becomes representative of minority populations, then the white people start moving out.
And
I imagine that would affect the policy.
And if that's right, that would duplicate the pattern of what happened in a lot of inner cities, too, wouldn't it, Bill Hudnut?
Yes, I think that it would. Race is sort of the elephant in the living room in all this. I prefer to cast it in economic terms. I think that often education success is equated with race or the lack thereof. One should be equated with economic standing of the family and so forth. And the same here. The people that can afford it move out, whether they're white or black or brown or Asian. The people that can't afford it are left to stay. And as you use it up, meaning the housing stock, the infrastructure, the commercial buildings, the old industrial age type buildings, the manufacturing and so forth. And that's left standing there while people pursue their dream.
Yet the example you use of a first ring suburb that tries to deal with this problem is Oak Park, Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Oak Park is, I think, a fine example of stabilizing the racial pattern so there is not a resegregation from all white to all African American. And Oak Park, through its housing programs and through various different counseling services, has made what I consider to be a heroic effort to keep from reaching that tipping point. They're right next to Chicago. And they're right next to a predominantly African-American community in Chicago. But they are trying consciously to avoid any kind of a tipping point, and they even reward people for staying. And it seems to be working out pretty well.
Well, in Oak Park, also, the cost of housing and property there is pretty prohibitive for most of the minorities that live in Chicago, as you know, many of them are you know, living in impoverished neighborhoods.
Yeah, that's why I say that to a certain extent it's an economic problem rather than a racial problem.
I do agree.
Mm-hmm. Well, Cecily, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thanks a lot.
We appreciate it. If you would like to join our conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address, TOTN@npr.org. We're speaking with Bill Hudnut about the problems of inner ring suburbs and his book, Halfway to Everywhere, A Portrait of America's First Tier Suburbs. When we return from a break, we're going to be talking about more ways some of these vital parts of our communities are trying to redevelop themselves and reinvigorate themselves. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The explosion of suburbs in this country after the Second World War, places like Levittown, produced a cultural reaction like this.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes, little boxes all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
Our guest, as we continue to discuss the first ring of America's suburbs, is Richard Hudnut, he's with us here in Studio 3A, and that was Pete Seeger performing Malvina Reynolds' Little Boxes. And Mr. Hudnut, it's a complaint about physical homogeneity and about cultural homogeneity as well. And one of the lessons that you seem to take away from your book is that it's difficult to categorize these places.
Well, it is. They're not all one and the same anymore. That song came from an era when Levittown was the model for suburban development. I went to Levittown on Long Island, and they're not all the same anymore. There have been additions and renovations, but I think Pete Seeger was probably pretty much on mark back in the 1950s. The same goes for the suburban development in various different places after World War II. It's not true of the suburbs before World War II as much, but they're built with ticky-tacky stuff, and plywood wears out, and roofs wear out, and after you've had two or three roofs on, there's not much place to go, and that's why these places are in trouble. And I think that it's important for us to emphasize the positive possibilities for reclamation and rebuilding and reinventing themselves. And that's what I try to do in this book.
Let's talk now with Chip, who joins us on the line from Cary, North Carolina.
How you doing, Neil?
Okay.
I just want to let you know, I have lived in Cleveland and then moved out to a suburb called Lakewood. Also lived in Pittsburgh and didn't actually live in Wilkinsburg, but another suburb called Penn Hills and then Monroeville. And now I'm in a suburb of Raleigh, North Carolina, called Cary. And I realized something that, when you guys were talking about this, that I hadn't realized before. Lakewood is also on the border of Cleveland, just like Euclid is on the other side. But Lakewood is a total different place than Euclid. There's a border street called 117th Street, West 117th Street, that separate Lakewood and Cleveland. If you drive down that street, if you look on the Lakewood side, which is the western side, it's beautiful. On the eastern side, on the Cleveland side, it's bombed out. Buildings, boarded up buildings, things aren't taken care of. Lakewood police and Lakewood people tend to take care of their town a lot better than I have seen personally in other cities like Euclid, like Wilkinsburg, so on and so forth. Hmm. They tend to care about their town, and the police seem to have a handle on things before they got bad as far as crime and everything else goes. Once people lose the pride in their city, I think that's when things start to deteriorate because everybody gives up and everybody leaves. And I think that's been a trend through all these different migrations away from someplace because they don't have pride in the city. The people in Lakewood have an extreme amount of pride. The difference between Cleveland and Lakewood, or even Euclid and Lakewood, and they're both the same types of cities, you know, as in terms of relationship to Cleveland, is like night and day.
Well, let's get a response from Bill Hudnut. I mean, clearly, you know, the people...
Well, the same thing's true in Pennsylvania, and I've noticed down here in Cary versus Raleigh, Durham, and all the other areas around here,
mm-hmm.
The police tend to be much more proactive. They're involved in the schools. I mean, Lakewood and Cary, I know for a fact, also manage their own school systems and do a really good job because I've been involved with both school systems, Lakewood as a child myself, and Cary's down here as a parent. And the involvement with the teachers, the pride, the community involvement with the police, even at the elementary and middle school level, is incredible. We had the most incredible middle school resource officer from Cary Police I have ever met in my life.
Well, let's say again.
That means a big difference, I think.
Okay, Chip, let's get a response from Bill Hudnut, and thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
Well, I think you're absolutely right about Lakewood. Lakewood is a very solid, 100% built-out community. It's much, much more residential than on the east side of Cleveland or the south side of Cleveland, Lakewood being on the west side of Cleveland. I had a cup of coffee on 117th Street, as a matter of fact, and it's hard to tell the difference between going from Cleveland to Lakewood. But by the same token, Lakewood has its problems. It's fiscally distressed. It's a member of the coalition of first-tier suburbs around Cleveland, and it is much more stable than some of them. So far as the crime is concerned, again, nobody's going to come to the party if they don't feel safe. You mentioned Wilkinsburg, Pennsylvania. One of my heartaches when I visited Wilkinsburg was to find out that there's not a single member of that police department that lives in Wilkinsburg. They all come in from outside and probably by definition, therefore, don't have the same kind of vested interest in the community as if they lived there. But certainly crime anywhere is a problem, and it goes up and down. I was mayor of Indianapolis for 16 years, and I never took credit for crime going down because I didn't want to get the blame when it went up, and it is cyclical.
One of the things that you point out is the unglamorous and talking about pride in a community and how it looks and all of that sort of thing, which is important, but is the rather unglamorous issue of code enforcement.
That's right, but it's very, very important. In Harvey, Illinois, which is a very, very poor suburb, the director of development there is making a very strong effort to enforce the codes, and she likes to brag about giving out 100 citations a day or a week or whatever it is. I forget the number that's in my book. And code enforcement, making people keep their properties up, requiring them to mow the grass or clean up the trash or fix broken windows, goes to the heart of one of the issues, which is what you might call the appearance and the image issue of these places. And certainly the caller is absolutely right that image and pride make a great big difference. And one of the things, frankly, that I noticed all over the place in Lakewood, but also in Euclid, was the determination and the resiliency of the human spirit, the determination to do better and to bring in some progress. And I think that's characteristic of many of these places, even though they're not heralded and they don't get much PR.
Joining us now from Westchester, Pennsylvania, is Dennis Androulis. He's a research professor at the State University Health Sciences Center at Brooklyn. He spent about the last 10 years studying social and health landscape of urban and suburban America, and it's good of you to be with us on Talk of the Nation.
Glad to be here.
In looking at the suburbs, what have you found in terms of health issues?
Well, it's not a clear pattern one way or the other in terms of the suburbs. In fact, I would say that from our work of looking at the 100 cities and their suburbs, that cities and suburbs in general on the measures we've looked at, poverty, maternal and infant measures, some of the demographic characteristics, that they're beginning to grow a little bit more together and certainly not as much apart as they once were. Now, this varies regionally, and listening to the discussions about what happens in Cleveland, about the older ring suburbs vary significantly from kind of the newer areas like out in California.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the findings we've had by health measures kind of begin to turn things a little on their heads. Like, for example, we found that the greatest increase in low birth weight infants among the 100 cities and suburbs occurred among white women in the suburban areas.
That seems to be counterintuitive.
It does seem to be counterintuitive, but there are dynamics that are creating kind of a phenomenon that people historically, traditionally thought, this is a city issue, this is a city problem, this city phenomenon, you have problems with access to care, you have problems of environment, ecological issues come up. But you're having now these issues emerge at a rate that has shocked some people in suburban areas.
Well, how come? What's the reason?
Well, in this case, for low birth weight, it could very well be assisted reproductive technology, women deciding to have children at later ages, and they may very well be eating well, going to their doctors, but are still having these low birth weight infants, and the implication now comes up as to who's going to serve a growing number of low birth weight infants, whether the the health needs are going to be similar or different from the traditional inner city access, nutrition, environmental issues you see and are more familiar with. And who's going to reach out besides the marketplace to tie to centers of excellence, neonatal intensive care units, pediatric intensive care, you know, the best doctors and treatments, the medical centers that tend to be located in the cities. That now the question comes up is as suburbs expand, you have changes in populations that have implications for social services, for health services. One thing that people have always thought is, well, you know, your cities are your mosaics and your melting pots. Well, we found that between 1990 and 2000, the increase in foreign-born populations in the cities were 41%. Well, the increases in the suburbs were 41% too.
Huh.
Now, what about language? There was about a 30% increase in people speaking a language other than English at home in the cities. Well, there was a 30% increase in the suburbs. Now, there's still more people in the cities. You know, about one in five in the cities speak a language other than English at home. But it's one in six in the suburbs. I mean, but so you've got these differentials. But what's happening is you're seeing these large increases that have implications for social services, for schools, for health care. That people before had said, well, this is a city issue, this is a city challenge. So there are perhaps more incentives for cities and suburbs to be getting and to be looking at some regional issues that can affect both in terms of health and social services, rather than saying cities are one way, suburbs are the other. Instead, suburbs may very well find themselves in a situation of kind of wringing their hands and say, what do we do here? Yeah. How do we face these new challenges that we thought were not ours? So, you know, just one last example, you go out to the western areas, and we found that in the latest years, 1999, 2000, we looked at infant mortality. Infant mortality was actually slightly higher in the western suburban suburbs than it was in the cities.
You're meaning California there?
Well, it's California, it's Arizona, it's Washington State, it's Oregon, it's all those areas, the western regions, Colorado. This is all part of the census-based western region. And what we found is that infant mortality as a whole, if you took the average, was actually higher in the suburban areas than the cities.
Dennis Andrulis, thanks very much. Those very interesting problems you're pointing out. Dennis Andrulis, a research professor at the State University Health Sciences Center at Brooklyn, and he was with us from Westchester, Pennsylvania. And Bill Hudnut, certainly health, one of the infrastructure issues that are coming to many of the questions are going to have to be answered.
Absolutely. I think that the public health question is one that must be addressed, and the conversation you had with the professor is very illuminating. I think there one of the answers, which I try to point to in my book, is the way in which suburban communities, particularly first-tier communities, and I don't know whether in his study he distinguished between the first tier and the second and third tier in his analysis, but in the first tier suburbs, you can find examples where they have tried to link in partnership with private sector groups and with nonprofits like universities. Let me give you just two examples. In Seat Pleasant, which is right outside of D.C. in Prince George's County in Maryland, there is a program that's called the Health Partnership between the city and the University of Maryland. And it's a fine program. It's being run by Dr. Gerald Greenberg. And it is involved right now in doing as much as it can with regard to two things: health education for all the people in Seat Pleasant and all the people that work for the partnership are volunteers, and secondly, securing the names of children that don't have health insurance so that they can be plugged into the children's health insurance program in the state of Maryland. And the next step in all this is going to be the establishment of a community health clinic in the city, a free health clinic that will be run by the university personnel. So I think that's one answer. Another kind of partnership has been formed in Windsor, Connecticut, right outside of Hartford, north of Hartford. And there they have the Healthy People Program. And that has two very interesting programs under it. One is the Start Smart program. There are about 350 babies born each year in Windsor. And if they're invited in, health personnel will go to every home where there's a new baby and talk to them about doing this kind of positive intervention that will keep the kids healthy as they get ready for school. And the other program is called a Vial of Life program, where everybody that has an emergency kind of a situation carries a vial with them that is supplied by the city in case they faint or something like that.
Our guest is Bill Hudnut. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's get another caller in. Don is on the line with us from Chardon, Ohio.
Hi.
Hi.
How you doing today?
Okay.
I'd just like to say that I recently, about 5 years ago, I moved out to the further in the suburbs, about 30 miles east of Cleveland. And my wife and I felt that we missed the arts and the culture, and the commute gets to be rough after a while. And we decided we were looking at about four different inner-ring suburbs on the east side of Cleveland, and we ended up purchasing a house in Euclid. And we move in next week.
Well, good luck to
you.
Very
interesting. I'm sure Mayor Oyaski will be glad to hear that.
I just think that the city almost gets a bad rep because it's really, Euclid is a nice city, and the thing that we liked about it was the people seemed to be really friendly, and a lot of the streets were really well maintained, and there were homeowners associations, and I just think that the city almost, you know, gets a bad rap in a way. Yes, it has its, you know, its trouble spots, as does Cleveland and many of the other inner-ring suburbs.
I think that you make a good point about wanting to be closer to arts and culture and the activity, and you can get to the Browns games easier and all that kind of business.
The Browns games, Playhouse Square, it's, you know, you have that long drive home every time you want to do something, and it's just, it's much more vibrant towards the city as opposed to out in the suburbs. And it's just, you know, we leave a path of destruction as we move further and further out. And if people don't start taking responsibility and going back to try and take care of the mess that we've made, that, you know, it's never going to get better.
Don, thanks very much for the call. And again, good luck. Bye-bye. But he does raise the point, and you raise it in the title of your book, Bill Hudnut, Halfway to Everywhere. In addition to the people you've talked about and the dynamism, location could be the solution.
Location is very important. And all these places that I went to, and there's some 80 suburbs probably that I visited in the first tiers around the country, they all, when I'd ask them, what's your largest asset, without exception practically, they would say our location. Mm-hmm. You go to Chelsea or Malden, Massachusetts, we're halfway from Boston to Logan Airport. You know, we're close to both. You go to a place out on the West Coast like Monrovia, and it's the same thing. And all over the country, people said, we think the location is one of our great strengths, and you have to build on your strengths.
We just have a minute or so with you left, but you started this project thinking that these inner ring suburbs were, going down the tubes. You've come to a different conclusion.
I've come to a different conclusion based on some of these assets we've just been talking about and that indefinable human spirit that I detected. I think there's a lot of hope. And they're at a fork in the road, the first-tier suburbs. They can go toward decline, or they can go toward new birth and rebirth. And in the life cycle of cities, it's possible, you know, not to just decline and die. It's possible to reinvent yourself and rebuild. And I think that's the challenge facing them. And they're going to need outside help to do it from the states and the feds. And this is a tough time to talk about that with the various different problems that we have with the federal deficit and all the rest of it. But nonetheless, there is hope. They're not a lost promise. They're a promise waiting to be fulfilled.
Bill Hudnut, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bill Hudnut, a senior resident fellow with the Urban Land Institute, the author of Halfway to Everywhere, a portrait of America's first-tier suburbs. When we come back, a look at the exurbs, the far-out suburbs still developing. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.